Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is William Reimer, the manager of the Regent College Bookstore in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he's been since 1989. He has previously managed other bookstores in Northampton, Massachusetts, and clerked at another one in Evanston, Illinois. Bill graduated from the University of Toronto with a Bachelor's of Science in 1977, received a diploma from the Seminary Consortium for Urban Pastoral Education in 1979, and also has master degrees from Regent College and the University of British Columbia, the latter school where he pursued doctoral studies and passed exams in Atlantic history and the Atlantic slave trade and abolition. Being around books for so much of his life, it was natural that he would contribute to our store of knowledge, and he is the author of the book Revisiting Toronto the Good, Violence, Religion, and Culture in a Late Victorian City, which was based upon research he did for his doctoral studies. Bill is married and the father of two adult sons, a daughter-in-law, and likes to spend his time woodworking, traveling, perusing baseball statistics, and, who would have guessed it, reading. Bill comes to us by way of John Owen, a former guest on the show, and if you have any ideas or suggestions for topics or guests, please email me at tgill@uw.edu. Love to hear from you. Bill, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Tony.
Oh, no problem. Baseball. We got to talk about baseball a little bit here. You're a born Canadian and from a town not too far away from Toronto, but you also lived in the Boston area. So what's the call here? Are you cheering for the Toronto Blue Jays or are you a Boston Red Sox fan?
Well, it gets complicated. I have been a lifelong Tiger fan. I inherited that from my father, who spent his teenage years on the Canadian side near Detroit, and he was quite a baseball player himself. So that's where the love for baseball came from. But in recent years, I have to say, I take a look at the Blue Jay statistics first. I like the Red Sox, but I am a little bit of a Cub fan, and what baseball fan this year could be disappointed if the Cubs win? So it's
we know that
nothing could happen at this point.
Yeah, we know that's not going to happen though, because it never does. Even though it looks like it. In fact, actually, we're recording this here in late September, and we'll air it in early October. So I just make a call. You're the baseball stats fan here. Any calls on the World Series? Who do you think's going to take the October Classic?
Boy, it's it looks like on paper it looks like it could be the Cubs, but. I might, if I was putting money on it, maybe the Red Sox at this point.
Okay.
They've got a lot of momentum, and I will be cheering for the Jays and the Tigers in there. So
okay.
I'm in trouble if it comes down to those two.
I thought you'd cheer for the Mariners since you're just up the road from us here in Seattle.
It's still a mathematical possibility there.
I guess I'm a football fan, so once September rolls around, the baseball goes off. So
yeah.
Well,
you did okay.
We'll see how it goes. Well, we're not here to talk about baseball all day, although I'm sure that you'd be happy to be doing that. But rather, we want to dig into your book, Revisiting Toronto the Good: Violence, Religion, and Culture in a Late Victorian City, which takes us back at least two decades into the 19th century, into the late 1800s. I'm a big fan of historical topics on our podcast, but had not you been recommended to me by our former guest, John Owen, I would have never have thought to look for a book on religion in the late 1800s that examined Toronto. So first question, I always ask this of my authors, is what possessed you to write a book on this topic?
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed I would have done that either, but I ended up revisiting my own backyard. I guess I have to go back to 97. I read a review of a book by Gertrude Himmelfarb called The Demoralization of Society, from Victorian Virtues to Modern Morals or something like that. And the review was in the New York Times Book Review. And she was taken to task for her use of crime statistics. So I was curious. She was arguing that British evangelicalism in Victorian Britain brought about a decline in crime. And so I was just interested with the argument, and I set out a little bit. I filed it in my head, in the back of my head, the topic, and returned to it later.
Well, there's an interesting story that you start off with your book and recounting this. So you have Himmelfarb rolling around the back of your head, but this was also born of a slam poetry contest or a concert. I don't even know what slam poetry is, but you got to explain to us how slam poetry works into all of this.
Sure. No, I knew of this poet by the name of Bud Osborne, who was a ex drug addict who was an activist on our downtown east side, and he had been at the college a couple times reading poetry, and I happened to be at the Vancouver Folk Festival one hot July day and noticed that he was scheduled to recite poetry in this tent, so I wandered over that way, and slam poetry, I guess. I'm not an expert on it, but I guess it's a poetry contest. There's a time limit. It tends to be poetry with an attitude, I guess, with its own rhythm and passion. And so I wandered over the tent, and he was reciting a poem that he'd written, and the refrain over and over again was F North American culture, F North American culture, F North American culture, although more explicitly. I'll honor your listeners' ears at this point. But I think in the printed version he added the North American culture of death. And I wasn't terribly offended, but I did, my wife and I walked up the big hill from down at the beach where the folk festival had taken place, and I was thinking about what would my grandparents' take be on that, apart from the from the wording. My grandfather had set out from Russia during the revolution with his family of 10 and headed for Canada. He wanted to get out of there, and at great cost they made it out. My maternal side were my grandparents were immigrants from England, and my grandfather, I need to make this short, I'm sure, was a 9-year-old whose mother was single, and he had lived with his grandparents who had died, I think, in the meantime. And when his mother married, he was shipped off to the colonies to live with his aunt. Came through Ellis Island. I found the passenger list, and settled in Hamilton, Ontario, in Toronto's hinterland with his aunt. And he eventually bought a little farm and made a go of it. Had a good-sized family. You know, a fair bit of tragedy along the way that I won't go into, but. And my dad's family settled in Winnipeg for the first few years in 1926. All survived the revolution, almost starved to death, but made it out and found Canada a good place. My grandmother, who was a remarkable woman, came to love Canada, even the royalty. She could remember the Tsar visiting her village in Russia, and lived to get a congratulatory letter from Prime Minister Mulroney on her 100th birthday that I have that I have in my possession. And I was able to record her story before she died, and I'm very thankful that I did that. But anyway, I'll get out into the weeds, as my wife says, of my ramblings at times here, so I better stop there.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But, mm-hmm. That's how I came. So I saw Canada as a good place mm-hmm. through their eyes.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. The title of the book is called Revisiting Toronto the Good. And later on, it'll be called The City of Churches, and we'll bring up that issue in a little bit. But why do you call it Toronto the Good? Why is that in parentheses, and what does that all mean?
Right, yeah. It comes from the mayoralty of Mayor William Howland, who was a businessman and reformer, evangelical Anglican reformer, actually. The son of a father of Confederation, he was a businessman, but he poured his life into the poor, serving the poor, and spent his most of his money on it. But he was the mayor for a couple terms in Toronto in the 1880s, and he set up a morality squad, quote unquote. And historians remember it as primarily focused on vice. Prostitution, alcohol, enforcement, etc. And so, but they forget his also the focus on the protection of women and children, as well as other reforming activities. And so, it originally was an epithet, a term of derision, Toronto the Good. It referred to this morality squad. In a moralistic kind of environment, but it's broadened to mean something much broader and more positive in recent years. Most people wouldn't be able to account for the origin of the term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It is a term that I thought to be fairly endearing, and as I read through your book, you come to the point where you say, well, you know, Toronto was really tamed. It's become a place where Canadians are good people, and they're a friendly folk, and that's one of the interesting things that comes from that. But it wasn't always that way, and now you had mentioned that your relatives arrived in Toronto area in the early part of the 20th century. Your book takes us back a few more decades, back into the 1800s. Give us an idea of what Toronto looked like in, say, the latter half of the 19th century. How big was it? Who was there? What did it look like religiously, ethnically, etc.?
Yeah, the turn of the century, the 1901 census, at that point, Toronto proper had a population of 156,000. It was 90% of the population would claim British roots in the British Isles. That's England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. So it was a very homogeneous population, which made that was helpful for some of the research. But it was an industrial town. It had a growing population, young men and women gravitated to the city. It was a tougher place at one time, although that's all relative. It wasn't a terribly violent place, although there is evidence from accounts of earlier residents of a lot more drinking at that point before the big temperance crusades that people like Howland were involved in, which reflected, I think, the concerns of women on an industrial frontier. They could have very large families. I recount the story of one woman who had 12 children, and at least one of them disabled from an industrial accident, and her husband died, and so they were very vulnerable. Women were, and very concerned about males and alcohol, rough behavior, and spending the the family income at the tavern was a problem in any developing industrial town or developed industrial town for that matter. I'm sure.
Yeah. So it's in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So Toronto, which is very close to the United States industrial Rust Belt, I guess now it's called the Rust Belt, but the industrial belt. So it too was an industrialized city, drawing a lot of young folks and kind of become a little bit of a rough and tumble city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh yeah. No, the crime certainly existed. I found a drop in homicide in crime. I use homicide as a general, a crude marker for violent behavior in general and crime.
Well, it is a pretty good measure, because once the body dies, it just kind of lays there. A lot of people, if they're mugged, don't necessarily report it, so you always have skewing in the data. But a dead body, it's hard to miss that one.
Right. And there's a general agreement among historians of crime that homicide is a much firmer measure than, say, common assault, which may be enforced to varying degrees over time in a culture.
Now, you also call Toronto the city of churches. Now, this might also come as a surprise to us folks here in the United States, where we look northward and we see, well, you know, yes, Canada is filled with friendly folks, but we don't consider them to be a very churchy folk. So how did Toronto become known as the city of churches at this time?
Right, yeah. Just the sheer number of churches and the church-goingness brought that about. So that's an early term. Charles Hemingway shows up in Toronto in 1920, a little later. He's working for the Toronto Star at that point. He writes in a letter to a friend of his, Christ, how I hated to leave Paris for Toronto, the city of churches. It just gives you an idea of its reputation, and maybe for Hemingway, its dullness. But downtown, the streets were, and in the neighborhoods, there were churches everywhere. The Methodists in the early 1890s, and Methodism, you can't discount the power of this movement. David Hempton at Harvard, an Irish historian, has written a book called Empire of the Spirit, published by Yale, on Methodism and its rise. The Methodists had 19 churches in the early 1890s that had seating capacities of 1,000 or more, and several of them seated 2,000 or more. One of them still sitting there on Queen Street in Toronto. A number of these large churches are still around. Perhaps a third of them still exist, but I counted about 90 churches in the core in the early 1890s. So, and church-going, as counted by church newspaper church censuses, were at the highest of any place on record, equal to a couple towns in Britain that had shared equal church attendance. So there is a very good data, too, for Toronto, and which helps the historian, including the annual or the decennial Canada census, which recorded religion all the way up to 1951, unlike Britain, where it was controversial to do that after 1851, and in the U.S., where there was the sharp separation of church and state. So there just isn't the data on religion that there is in Canada, which makes it very nice for the researcher.
Yeah, no, definitely, and it's a good place. And you do have a lot of data that you've collected for this book, and we're going to talk about some of that. Actually, it's really interesting to think that there were churches that could seat 1,000 to 2,000 people back in the 1890s, and we were talking about a population of 150,000 or so in Toronto. That's a pretty hefty sized church for a city that size.
Yeah, almost a seat for the everyone everyone in the city. So you could, and they weren't always full, of course, but there was a tremendous seat wars competition between denominations, and they all grew during this period, Catholic, Anglican, but the Methodists, the Presbyterians, and the Baptists and Methodists in particular, grew at a disproportionate rate, and it reflected their growth in membership or attendance at this time. Yeah.
So what you do in your book specifically is to examine the role of evangelical Christianity, these growing Methodist and Baptist and Presbyterians, as having an effect on violent crime rates in Toronto. But you situate your book early on in a broader dialogue of the decline of interpersonal violence that scholars have been fascinated for a really long time. And this is something that I think may shock anybody living in contemporary times and anybody who listens to the news, because there's always this relatively consistent drumbeat that we're always a more violent society and there's all this crime. But there's been a long-term trend away from a violent society, and that actually goes back several centuries. Occasional upticks here and there, but give us an understanding for what this trend, this long-term, century-long-term trend has been, and how scholars have approached it, because that will help set up what you have to say.
Yeah, the trend that is accepted by virtually all specialists is that since medieval times, interpersonal violence declined, going back to even the 1300s. Britain has the best data. It's sporadic and fragmentary, but what they have clearly shows much higher levels of homicide. Ted Robert Gurr was the first one to, he was the one to point out the graph. He pieced together a number of studies in Britain, the existing studies showing this drop, and also some in the U.S. And there's a U-shaped curve going back to medieval times that continues down. Maybe it flattens by my time in the late 19th century, but then rises sharply in the 1960s, and that stimulated a lot of the academic study of violence, the actual experience in cities in the Western world in particular. But then it has dropped somewhat. It didn't climb back up to medieval times, but did get pretty high there through the 1990s throughout the Western world.
Trend is pretty surprising, considering that, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so I understand or remember people saying, oh, increased urbanization is a cause of this crime and urban problems, blah, blah, blah. During this whole period of time, the last several centuries, urbanization has really been increasing, especially in the 1800s into the early 1900s. And yet you do see this trend of declining interpersonal violence. So how are people explaining this?
It happened in the cities going back were generally safer places in the rural areas. They explained it in terms of culture, that culture was growing, developing chains of interdependencies. Norbert Elias, refugee from Hitler's Prussia, he got out in 37-38 somewhere in there, and wrote a book, ironically, perhaps from where he had been, called The Civilizing Process, and that made its way into print, into English in the 1970s, and stimulated some fair bit of theoretical thinking among historians, and they realized that there was this U-shaped curve, and often speculated that it was changes in religion, Methodism, Sunday school, etc., etc. Manuel Eisner, at the around 2000. He's a Swiss scholar who heads up the Institute of Criminology at Cambridge University in England. He put together an even larger, he pieced together an even larger set of studies in Europe and England that gave this U-shaped curve more detail. And he speculated that it was a change associated with Protestant changes in Northern Europe without getting really into a study of evangelicalism. But he does call on historians to look more carefully at individual moralizing processes. Robert Muchenbled from the University of Paris called for similar things and speculated particularly on the domestication of males by culture, and where increasingly violence was unacceptable. And and so I picked up from there in looking very specifically at Toronto and arguing that sure, this process was already underway. Violence was declining. Maybe it bumped up a bit at mid-19th century. I'm not sure on that, but I haven't studied closely that those decades. But definitely I saw it dropping across the 1880s and 1890s, and it wasn't a blip. It remained low all the way up until 1960. It's higher in Canada today than it was at the turn of the century, the homicide rate, and I think it's fairly accurate, the rates that are recorded. And that's despite today having trauma medicine. We have cell phones, medevacs, victims are brought into hospitals very quickly and brought back from the brink in a way that they couldn't during my time period. And even with this, the rate for Toronto, homicide rate for Toronto in my period is lower than today. And although today it's very it's a very safe place despite the headlines on occasion.
Well, that's good to hear, because I will be coming out to Toronto in later, I think in late January of 2017. Okay. So any of you listeners in Toronto, please stop out and say hi to me. I'll be speaking at the University of Toronto. So just a little plug there.
Oh, very good.
And since you said the University of Toronto, or Toronto, is a very safe place, I was happy to see that.
Enjoy it.
Now, one of the things that you do is you do pick up on Manuel Eisner's work, and really kind of dig into the details, saying, okay, yeah, maybe this religious culture has an effect on it. And you look into the nitty-gritties of this in one specific city, which makes it a really rich historical study, and I want to recommend people do pick up your book. We'll link to it on our website. You focus specifically on British evangelical Protestantism, BEP, as you call it in there. I might call it BEP from now on. It's hard to pronounce. Had an impact on that. So what is this British evangelical Protestantism, and how did it get into Toronto in the late 1800s?
From immigration, and almost all of it was from the British Isles. And evangelicalism was a very portable religion. Methodism, transplanted very readily. It wasn't dependent on a hierarchical diocesan structure, but this was true in the U.S. too. I don't want to draw too much of a divide between the U.S. and Canada. The same movements were going on in the U.S., and the U.S. is more complicated, but there are certainly regions in the U.S. Went the same process, and if you looked at the data, as somebody like Randy Roth has from Ohio State University in his big study on American homicide with Harvard University Press, so I don't want to make too much of a divide there. But certainly the Toronto Christianity had its roots in the British Isles, and it was flavored. It had this British flavor, even if the key ministers, many of them were born in Canada, their parents or grandparents had in turn come from the British Isles, and often the churches imported ministers from Britain. That was true of even my Baptist upbringing near Toronto. I remember two or three British pastors. For some reason, you know, churches often went to Britain for preachers, and so there was this British flavor of evangelicalism that had its roots in the evangelical revival. And when you think of the names Whitfield, Wesley, etc., you know, eventually a reformer like Wilberforce, and the folk I'm studying, many of them were basically a continuation of these British reform movements, but abolitionism being the big one, which had really become a machine, you know, a propaganda machine, good propaganda as far as I'm concerned, but they brought about the abolition of slavery, as did many in the U.S., of course, and so there's no great divide there. There are regionally divides, of course, but there was this reform, British reform tradition, and George Brown, the founder of with his father of the Globe, which later became the Globe and Mail, was already a abolitionist in Edinburgh, and he dies in 1880. And Oliver Mowat, a friend of his, who became the premier of Ontario for 24 consecutive years, was also an abolitionist, a young abolitionist on a committee with Brown in Edinburgh, and he was eventually became known as the Christian politician, and simultaneously was the president of the Evangelical Alliance in Canada. So you see that tight, particularly evangelicals identify with the Liberal Party, and evangelicals basically controlled the Liberal Party in Ontario, even if it wasn't a central control, it was a effective control.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about how some of these evangelicals, specifically William Howland, takes over the political machine there, becomes a religious political machine to some extent. But in terms of the British evangelical Protestant theology of this time, are there certain characteristics that it's emphasizing that would make us think that it would have an impact on interpersonal violence, and basically tamping it down?
Sure. David Bevington, who has hung out at Baylor University, I think, has described it as a evangelical quadrilateral with the emphasis on conversion, you know, a change of the heart of the individual, a focus, sort of a mystical focus on Christ and his work on the cross. The centrality of the authority of Scripture, all resulting in an activism, whether you know, missionary activity or reforming activity, as in abolitionism. Weber argued that the Protestant ethic was interdirected and involved one giant disciplining process, and bred qualities into the individual, qualities required for membership in the community, diligence, thrift, sobriety, honesty, prudence, self-control, and certainly non-violence. You can see, and these are the qualities that it took for membership within voluntary Protestantism, Methodists, and whether the class meeting or Baptists. I'm not discounting the inner quality of the evangelical religion, but outwardly it emphasized certain behaviors, which were in effect a giant disciplining process that Weber called it. That's basically what I'm arguing. Eisner, without going into detail with respect to evangelicalism, also is emphasizing that there's this moralizing process going on, particularly for young males, and much of the teaching with respect to behavior was directed at males, young males in particular. The warnings about the road to perdition, to even the gallows, beginning with these you know, cigarettes or alcohol or what have you, in terms of behavior that's outside of what was expected in Christian communities of this type.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that is occurring at this time, as we mentioned, it was an industrializing city. This is attracting a lot of young men. Young men are the ones who get in trouble, right? That you can't help that. They're the ones going to be causing the fist fights and leading the murder and all that kind of stuff. But the Christianity at this time, it has to deal with that. And you talk about this emphasis on true manliness and also some of the virtues of proper sexuality and marriage and that. So what are the preachers at this time really trying to tell these young single males?
Yeah, that sexuality belongs in the marital union. Alcohol, temperance, whether or not the preacher was a prohibitionist, and not all evangelicals were prohibitionists. The temperance was increasingly over the course of the century emphasized, and Methodists almost totally became prohibitionists when Wesley was leery of the movement early on, and you know, it wasn't a mark of a, you know, certainly temperance was a mark, but prohibition wasn't a Methodist marker in the early years. So true manliness in terms of the husband was providing for the family and not beating up one's wife, quote unquote, being a wife beater. And there's a lot of wife beater discourse in the newspapers, headlines about wife beaters, and this is part of evangelical messages that emanated from the pulpit. The printing evangelicals made very good use of the printing press and education. There was a move to get temperance, and this is a Methodist minister of education, Egerton Ryerson, however it's pronounced, who was a famous Canadian both politician and Methodist minister and minister of education. There was a move to get temperance into the curriculum of Ontario, and so it was a major move. And women overwhelmingly were supporters of prohibition in the plebiscite in 1894. 85% of eligible women in Ontario voted for prohibition. A slight majority of males did as well, but I argue that that disproportionate vote points to this being a major concern of women.
It's interesting that you linked your research that you're doing in Toronto to somebody who I know who had done research in Latin America, and that's Elizabeth Brusco, who's just down here in the Puget Sound. And when I read that reference, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is makes a lot of sense that in Colombia there's a very similar thing, that evangelicals put the emphasis on what is true manliness. It's not going out and carousing and drinking and philandering and all that. It's staying home and taking care of the family. And as soon as you did that, all of a sudden crime rates start dropping. There's more income in the family household, and you do better, everything like that. I think they called it redemption and lift. So now this works its way in. You mentioned that the evangelicals were very good at printing presses. They're starting to get this into the curriculum as well, talking about temperance. And it works its way, and one of the interesting parts of your story is that it works its way into the political machinery or the political landscape of Toronto during this period of time through this guy named William Howland, and we've mentioned him a few times. Who is this guy, and how does he get to become such a big deal in Toronto?
Yes, he's the son of a father of Confederation, William P. Howland, and he inherits a position in the insurance in an insurance company. But I guess he was an okay businessman, but he spent most of his time as a social reformer, working with the poor, and in his church, his weekly Bible class at an local Anglican church. He's in prisons constantly, working for prison reform, etc. And he eventually, I don't know that he set out to be a politician, but he thought, particularly with temperance, if he ran for mayor, it would do good. And he served two terms. The term was 1 year, but he served two terms as mayor. And his associates later also tended to dominate the next decade in that position of mayor. But he brought about temperance reform as well as he was one of the founders of the Humane Society in Toronto in the 80s. And he had a very he had his fingers in virtually every evangelical reform association, at least as a figurehead, although it was often the women that did the work on the ground. He was certainly a leader. And as far as I can tell, he was a loved mayor. The folk lined up by the thousands when he died at a relatively young age in 1893. But the funeral procession was just lined by thousands of people, including poor people. He had a profound effect on the place. I think federally he was a liberal, but he ran as an independent in Toronto, and left a good impression on folk overall, and would have won the next election by all accounts, but decided to he was just broke from spending his money on relief efforts, reform efforts, stepped down and continued his efforts until his death.
This was a politician who really put his money where his mouth is. And in reading through the discussion of Howland, I'm like, wow, why can't we get politicians like this anymore? It was really fantastic. He engaged in a number of different policies. As you mentioned, he was big into temperance movement and building. You're getting evangelical ideas into educational systems and into creating different civic associations to basically keep the society running smoothly. One of the other things that he was very interested in, and this relates directly to what you're talking about, crime and crime rates, is to go into prisons. Prison mission, prison reform was big on that. And it was motivated by a couple of cases. You talked about some of these hangings of Robert Neal and Pegleg Brown. Tell us a little bit about this and then how it worked into his vision of prison reform and how this affected society in general.
Yeah, so he was already involved earlier in the Prisoners' Aid Society shortly after some kind of a conversion experience he had in the early 80s. He got involved with Prisoners' Aid, and then so he regularly counseled prisoners, which didn't have articles written up necessarily, but this one case of an Irish kid who had been flogged in prison and I think quite abused by the guards. In a moment, he knifed a guard, and he was 18 at the time, I think, and eventually the guard died, and Neal was condemned to death, and William Howland and a Methodist minister, Johnston, I think was his name, they were his spiritual counselors and visited him regularly and then went to the gallows with him. And it's very, very moving but deeply saddening passages that you read in detail on the, you know, a condemned's last last day, that kind of thing. But I was, it was quite moving. The way they, Howland and this Methodist minister identified with this condemned, Robert Neal, and wrote a public letter pleading for clemency, and wrote to the justice minister in Ottawa concerning his concerning clemency, arguing that the state had let this poor kid down. He never had a break in his life, and and so he really went to bat for him out of compassion, and one can't help but take one's hat off. And I talk about the case of Pegleg Brown, which is a little afield over in London, Ontario, but it typified evangelical involvement that often, you know, just wasn't written up, except for the fact that these were capital cases. We wouldn't know about it otherwise, but this was typical visiting prisoners type of activity that they did. Pegleg Brown was an escaped convict from Texas. There was a shooting of a policeman in London, Ontario, and the suspect was peg-legged, and so peg-leg men started getting picked up around the country and in the U.S. But eventually, this Marion Brown was picked up in Washington and brought up into British Columbia and sent by rail across to London through Toronto for trial, which the trial was flawed by all, you know, by the counts of lawyers who protested Brown being condemned. Whether or not he was entirely guilty or innocent is unknown, but he was surrounded in prison by evangelical visitors, women from, you know, Methodist, several Methodist women, Methodist, Salvation Army during the day and at night, and particularly the night before the execution, you know, a Methodist lay postal worker spent the night with him and a couple of others praying and singing. And there was a Presbyterian minister, Robert Johnston, who made a probably, I don't know, 300-mile one-way carriage trip to Ottawa to try to visit with the Governor General to see if he if clemency could be obtained, and he came back in time for the execution. And it is a powerful account of this small group of evangelicals befriending someone who had no support at this point, and would have otherwise just died all alone. It was a moving account. I decided to include it, even though it wasn't Toronto, but it illustrated the involvement of a community of Christians with someone condemned. I want to be careful about claiming too much for how these accounts worked. I would argue that they worked in a contagion fashion, that as did anti-slavery rhetoric and propaganda, that eventually they work into a population, perhaps like, seatbelt usage or anti-smoking discourse, that there is a effect, even if you can't, correlation is not causation, of course, but I just tried to build a persuasive argument without claiming that I proved a whole lot, but...
So one of the other things that you bring up in terms of this contagion effect is the reaction that a lot of Canadians, especially these evangelical Protestants, had to the Dreyfus Affair in France at the time, and then also these anti-Jewish pogroms that were going on in Europe. And it's interesting because the nature of the dialogue that these evangelicals engage in really changed the cultural milieu and affect the rates of violence. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Dreyfus Affair in the 1890s in France, Captain Dreyfus became a cause for many evangelicals, both in Britain, Canada, and the U.S., with regular newspaper reporting on the affair and the unjust accusations. And in the U.S., of course. Along with anti-Jewish pogroms that were going on at the time, they were reported on regularly, both in Russia, Poland, anti-Jewish sentiment in other parts of Europe, and there was a lot of support for Jewish refugees in the evangelical community, both in Britain and Canada. And Jewish refugees went disproportionately to the U.S., Canada, and Britain when they could have gone to closer locations. But the support. The level of reporting raised awareness of the dilemma of many in the world, and brought about feelings of wanting to help. And then in the early Armenian atrocities in the 1890s, I believe, also were widely reported on, and there were urges for Britain to act on behalf of Christians that were being massacred, as it was reported, and I think there's a good eyewitness accounts of that. It was seen as a cause, and it heightened, awareness of violence in general in the world, and helped bring about. greater peacefulness in a contagion style, in a contagion way. That would be my argument, even though, you know, it's hard to prove the exact results.
No, it is a convincing argument, and I find it's very interesting how you document throughout the book that the dialogue kept going, and the evangelicals are saying, you know, true manliness is not getting in bar fights late at night. It's you know, it's manning up and taking care of others, and not only your family but those around you, and you know, the empathy and compassion for prisoners as well. It really changed the tenor of the dialogue in that period of time, and I love this phrase that you use in the book, that this all became the roots of the peaceful Canadian. And us down here in the lower 48 just love our peaceful Canadian neighbors up to the north. We never have to worry about you much because you're such great neighbors. So a lot of that has influence there.
Well, thank you, but I don't want to focus entirely on evangelicals. There were Unitarians involved in this in these concerns as well, but they were very small groups. Evangelicals had the personnel, so to speak, and the capacity, the infrastructure that was developed over time, both with anti-slavery missionary movements. Going into temperance and factory reform, humane society movements, etc. And it was a the voluntary societies were huge in a way that it's hard for us to imagine today. We think of it just morphing into government activity on behalf of the poor, say, but some of the voluntary associations in London at this time had larger budgets than some European governments. So it's on a scale that has eluded our memories because these associations have disappeared and. Even their records sometimes. You do see some buildings yet that are used in different ways now, but it's still where there still is a record of this activity in urban areas in particular.
Let me ask you about some final reflections on this, and I always love to ask this question of historians. You're looking at Toronto, Canada, roughly 100, 125 years ago or so. Are there any lessons that we could draw from understanding what went on during that period of time for our lives here? And was there anything in doing this research that surprised you along the way?
Right, yeah. I think there is a lot we can learn from these efforts, that social capital is formed by who we are in our neighborhoods, how we treat folk around us, young people, how we provide opportunity, how our church activities too are very, very important. I work around the corner from a coffee bar in the same space. Actually, there's a coffee bar that we lease out. A coffee bar space that we lease out to a coffee company, and there's a kid that works around the corner. I think he's 21, 22. He's a pilot in training. He flies seaplanes and is a barista as well, but the church he goes to has taken on the children of a woman who has been a substance abuser and has lost her children. But they have taken over the care of her children. So this young man often sleeps overnight where these kids live, apart from their woman, apart from their mother. He's up changing diapers at night, and has really, this small group of church members has committed to looking after these kids until their mother is in better shape and rehabbed. And it gives me hope. I've also just finished a book called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance from the U.S., who grew up hillbilly, as he calls it, in Appalachian culture. And he has written a passage that he, which describes what I'm talking about here, and he gives a lot of credit to the church from within his culture, and mentions the phrase "the grace of God" a couple times, and that he's on some kind of a Christian journey. But he ended up graduating from Yale Law School, and it's been number one on the New York Times list, I think, for a couple of weeks back, a little bit. But he's describing a little scene here. I don't know if there's time for this or not, but it's one chunky paragraph. A couple of years ago, I was driving in Cincinnati with Usha, my wife—that's his wife—when somebody cut me off. I honked. The guy flipped me off, and when we stopped at a red light, this guy in front of me, I unbuckled my seatbelt and opened the car door. I planned to demand an apology and fight the guy if necessary, but my common sense prevailed, and I opened the door before I got out of the car. Usha was delighted that I'd changed my mind before she yelled at me to stop acting like a lunatic, which has happened in the past. She told me that she was proud of me for resisting my natural instinct. But he goes on, and I think that this is the some of the process that I've been talking about, and it gives you hope that social capital is. Robert Bowling Alone Putnam calls it can be reformed, and I know that the church is part of that and has been a part of that. It's not the only part of that process, but I argue that it's been an important part of the process, and it does give me hope at this point, even though a return to increased church going seems a long ways away here in Canada, but we journey on in hope.
Yeah, well, those are very optimistic words to finish off on, and I echo them as well. My guest today has been Bill Reimer. Bill, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's been great to chat, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.